This episode of Linoleum Knife is brought to you by Film Movement Plus.
Film Movement Plus is a streaming service for fans of independent film. It opens a world of award-winning entertainment, including some of the best movies from prestigious festivals around the globe. Among the hundreds of titles waiting for you to discover are acclaimed films that you won't find anywhere else, plus newly restored classics and award-winning shorts with new films added every week.
Available on all your favorite devices, including Roku, Apple TV, and Amazon Fire, Film Movement Plus is priced at $5.99 a month. But Linoleum Knife listeners can get a 14-day free trial plus 50% off their first three paid months using the promo code KNIFE. Sign up today at filmmovementplus.com and use the promo code KNIFE.
That was the most professional reading of ad copy that we have ever done.
I think so.
We read it straight.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't embellish.
Nope.
We didn't go hmm and huh and bleh and make funny noises.
Hand us a script and we can actually deliver.
We're really good at podcasting.
We are.
Here's some theme music.
A podcast of the cinema, starring you, Dave White, and me, Alonzo Duralde.
We're film critics. He is the film reviews editor at The Wrap. I am one of their writers. That means he's my boss and editor. He's also my husband, which means I'm his boss.
Oh, God.
That's right.
Stop now.
You know how it works. You know what's up. I am also the new breakout star of the Deck the Hallmark podcast.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, true. I am. I really am.
The toast of the town.
They you're Crystal and I'm Nomi, and you better watch out.
Okay.
Because here comes here comes the new dancer, the new goddess.
We could have gotten anyone for this show.
Janet. Suzanne.
Suzanne. Paula Abdul.
Paula Abdul. We have some films to... Well, okay.
We have to address the bummer elephant in the room, I guess.
Yeah, before we talk about films. The reason this episode is kind of late is on Sunday we got the shocking news that our friend James Rocky had died.
Yes.
Early that morning.
Yes.
There we got up and we recorded Linoleum Nights. And then I recorded my Deck the Hallmark episode. And then the minute I got done recording, you said, oh no. And you were reading the, I guess it was the tweet about it.
Yeah, Scott Weinberg on Twitter had been in touch with James's wife, Ariane. Apparently on Saturday night, James was feeling chest pains. He went into the hospital, and at about 4 o'clock in the morning, he had a heart attack, and there was nothing that the hospital staff could do to prevent it. And so, he was 53. He has a friend of the podcast, both in real life, but actually like has been on the show.
Long time.
Yes, very early on. And I think we were on various podcasts that he hosted over the years.
Yeah.
And even though he left film criticism in about 2015.
Sometime around there.
Yeah. We still hung out with him and his wife, Ariane, even though we weren't seeing him at screenings all the time. And
right.
Enjoying the pleasure of him telling people to turn off their cell phones in that uniquely booming yet super polite Canadian way of his.
James is the man who honestly gave me permission to shout people down in screenings who were
misbehaving.
Now this is how long ago it was, because I have since broken myself of the habit. Well, someone else broke me of the habit. A truly psychotic woman at a screening of The Beach Bum.
Yes.
Who was beyond out of control. And after I was done yelling at her and she shouted me back, and it went back and forth, I thought, you know what? I'm not doing this anymore. I can't. I can feel my blood pressure. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And but while I was in practice,
your glory years.
I was good, and James is the one who sort of opened that door for me. We were sitting. He was already doing it at press screenings, large and small. He didn't care. Yeah. It was a small room, and you could see who was the one shouting at you. this is the great moment. We were sitting in a screening of whatever, I can't remember what movie it was, but he was sitting right next to me. And some oblivious older man was down front and had an extremely bright screen. Mm-hmm. While the movie was going.
Of course, in the front row.
In the front row. And I looked at James, and James looked at me, and it was sort of this sort of thing of like, do you want to do it, or do you want me to do it? And he kind of gestured with his hand like, please,
after you.
Please, after you, please do it. And I won't shout into the microphone, but my voice carries.
It does.
And
can attest.
And I shouted, turn off that GD phone. This is a clean podcast. I'll be just using initials of the swears that I employed in that moment. And the guy shouted back at me.
Oh, really?
And he said, I'm checking something. And I said, I don't give an F about you or whatever it is you need. Turn off that GD phone now. And James looked at me, and I looked back at James, and we agreed that that moment had been a success.
James was just like so funny and a great writer. I was so thrilled that I got to have him at the Wrap for a while before he left the business entirely. And he left the business in a way that made you think, oh yeah, we should really all leave this business. but yeah, just a one of a kind guy. And the outpouring on film Twitter on Sunday of people who had just personal reminiscences, who talked about how, oh, when I was at a festival and I was just getting started and I didn't know anybody, and he was the first person to be super friendly and supportive, or he helped me get this job, or he, you know, was always really kind. And it's the kind of obits that you read and think, wow, I hope I earn a tenth of this sometime. But yeah, he was unique.
He would invariably, when he ran into me at a screening, he would make exactly the same joke about the German power metal band Helloween. It didn't matter where it was or what we were doing. He would just start talking about Helloween, and he would make the same joke about, put on a great live show. And after a while, one day I said to him, you know, James, I actually don't even really care about the band Helloween. He's like, well, you should.
He loved the euphemism melon farmer, which came from the TV edit of, I think, 48 Hours or something. Just did not suffer fools, but really loved movies and was just the nicest person.
I know we're telling fun stories about him right now. But I've been kind of wandering around in a daze for the past couple of, for about the past 48 hours, because it's one thing when someone dies.
When Stephen Sondheim dies and he's 91.
You're like, okay, we're ready for that.
Yeah.
We know that's coming. We've done a little prep work, you know.
It's been in the back of our mind that this is inevitable.
When it's someone your age and it's this quick and it's this sudden and it's this
no lead up,
unfair and enraging, And when you're not just a passing acquaintance or someone that you're kind of friendly with.
Yes.
When an actual friend of yours dies, it's very hard.
Yes.
And so I've been decorating the Christmas trees to keep busy. I've also done a lot of cooking. And, you know, we have to keep doing what we're doing. So we're unhappy and we're upset and we're going to miss James Rocky.
Yes.
And it's just this absolutely sad, horrible thing.
And it sounds corny, but it's true. If you have friends that, you know, especially in the last couple of years where, you know, you've had to be away from people, perhaps, or they've had to be away from you, drop them a line. Yeah. Let them know you're thinking about them.
Yeah.
See how they're doing. Touch base.
Nobody bother me, though, please.
No. I'm just... We do a podcast. You know how we are. We tell you at least once a week how we're doing.
I want to be left alone most of the time. We have two movies.
Yes.
That we're going to talk about today.
One new, one's a bit of a catch-up that is now streaming.
The catch-up is Last Night in Soho.
Yes.
And it came out to theaters when? Like September, October?
Something like that.
Yeah. And sank like a stone.
Apparently.
My understanding is that nobody went to see this film. Someone can give me some box office numbers if they want, but... You know, and that surprised me because Edgar Wright, the filmmaker, mm-hmm. you know, he's a popular director. People like what he does, and I would have thought that, you know, his fan base would have been like, oh, Edgar Wright.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean...
He's a director with a name.
He is. You know? He definitely has a fan base, but, you know, I think also he is loved greatly by those who love him, but I think there's probably large swaths of the movie-going community that have no idea who he is. You know, I remember the big to-do about Scott Pilgrim versus the World, where there were really high hopes for that movie, and it didn't do the numbers. And obviously...
Oh, did it not?
In its original release, no. It has maintained itself, I think, as a cult entry since then.
My bubble is such that everyone I know saw it and loved it. So we were talking about it.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Continue.
So, yeah. So I think, yeah, this movie, you know, it seemed like, you know, he'd been generating press all year because of the Sparks documentary early on. You know, Anya Taylor-Joy is coming off of Queen's Gambit. And and again, I think this will, and as like pretty much all of his movies, sort of endure as a cult item and will... You know, probably have a big afterlife in, you know, Blu-ray and streaming and whatnot. You know, I don't think the Cornetto trilogy was a giant smash in the U.S. anyway, box office wise, but people still talk about those movies.
Right. So Last Night in Soho is about a young woman played by Thomasin McKenzie.
Yes.
She's from the North. She goes to the South.
Of the U.K.
Yes. She
Britain,
goes down to London and does not have a smashing time.
No, despite the fact that her grandmother is played by Rita Tushingham.
Who was the star
of Smashing
Time. Smashing Time, a comedy from the late 60s.
Yes.
About two young dollies.
From the North,
From the North. Yeah. They're apparently, didn't you tell me once that Lynn Redgrave was doing a Geordie
voice, yes.
Voice, and that her kids used to love.
They would like ask her to do it around the house.
Around the house, yeah. Go look up Geordie. It's too complicated to explain.
I just a quick insert here. I never ask celebrities to sign things when I encounter them in a professional basis, unless the thing I have is so cool that I think they'll be delighted to see it.
Yes.
I had Lynn Redgrave sign my soundtrack for Smashing Time.
Yeah.
And she was delighted.
Thomasin McKenzie, whose grandmother is played by British 60s screen legend Rita Tushingham, star of A Taste of Honey.
Yes. And she is the character to whom Alec Guinness is telling all of the story of Dr. Zhivago.
Yeah. So Thomasin McKenzie is an aspiring fashion designer with a love of all things from the 1960s.
Yes.
The look, the design of everything.
Scylla clothes, Black Records.
Scylla Black Records. She loves all the music from that era. She's listening to
Dusty Springfield,
the Walker Brothers, you name it. She goes to a fashion college in London. She immediately has to get out of the dormitory because her roommate and all of her roommate's friends are hideously terrible people.
The worst.
and so she goes and rents a room at the top of an old house in Soho. And the house is owned by, here we go again, with another icon of the 1960s.
Dame Diana Rigg.
Diana Rigg.
In her final performance.
Final movie, yep. This got held back because of COVID, so in that meantime, Diana Rigg passed away. And when she goes to stay in that room, things begin to happen. Things that at first appear to be a dream. And what happens in that dream is that she is transported back to the 1960s and into the body of a young woman named Sandy, played by Anya Taylor-Joy.
It's mentioned early on that Thomasin McKenzie's character, like, still communes with her dead mother. Like, she has a gift for sort of seeing into the spirit world or something. It's never, they don't put too fine a point on it, but the character is set up that she has this ability to, you know.
She's more than that. She more than that ability that she seems to have that is never fully explained. She also is dealing with some sort of mental health challenge that apparently also was part of her mother's life as well. Again, it is never fully explained. It is simply background color,
right,
for what she is about to go through. And what she's about to go through, as I said, is that she is sort of
reliving Sandy's
life.
Yeah.
But Sandy's life is very difficult, and it involves
Matthew Smith as a club owner who basically exploits her.
And is a pimp.
Yeah.
Yeah. These dreams, experiences, whatever you want to call them, become increasingly horrific as, what is Thomasin McKenzie's name in the movie? Emily?
No, Eloise.
Eloise, that's right. Ellie. Okay. She, because that's, there's a song called Eloise. That's yes. And Sandy is a sort of a reference to Sandy Shaw, who was a singer back then as well. And it becomes apparent to Ellie that based on her what information she can get from these dreamlike visions. Experience and visions is that Sandy has possibly been murdered.
Yes.
So she kind of goes on a hunt for the killer. She thinks she has found the killer in
yet another 60s icon.
Terrence Stamp, who hangs out at the pub that Ellie gets a job at.
Yeah.
As a barmaid. So, and it goes from there. And I won't give away anything else because it unfurls in this way that always has more information for you that eventually begins to contradict itself and point you in new directions in a manner not unlike, this film is heavily influenced by Suspiria. It is a psychological horror film about a woman whose experience may or may not really be happening.
I was thinking about Repulsion also.
Repulsion as well, yeah. There are certainly visual cues, visual references to both Suspiria and repulsion.
Yeah.
And you'll notice them as the film goes on. Finally, all is revealed. Horrific climax. Again, we're not going to tell you what's going on. What did you think?
Well, you know, sadly, it is at the horrific climax where it kind of fell apart for me.
All right.
Some of the revelations regarding things.
Yeah.
I found dissatisfying, I think, at least in terms of what the movie is saying about these characters and how they interact. That left me a little annoyed, even though it did offer some good acting opportunities. But I still think just the idea of it didn't sit well with me, and I didn't see why it did what it did. But as is so often the case with Edgar Wright movies, you can just enjoy the trappings because the trappings are so great. In this case, all of his like bringing the, you know, mod 60s back to life in all of their glory is a delight to watch. The way that he makes what's left of it in the modern day seem like these kind of weird fragments, whether it's, you know, Terrence Stamp and Rita Tushingham, whether it's like the way that a building could a business could change entirely, but the sort of, you know, stone, what, a portico? What's the word for that?
I guess.
The archway over the door, you know, remains the same. And so that's how she's able to connect the past to the present. You know, I like the performances. I think both Thomas and Mackenzie and Anya Taylor-Joy are terrific in this. You know, the great music choices, like the needle drops are deeper cuts. You know, when they play a Kink song, it's not, you know, one of the obvious ones. They play Starstruck. There's a lot that I liked about it, but I just, the ending to me was not satisfying.
Edgar Wright is a pop art director.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think this movie marries what he does well with subject matter that I question how he handles it. There's an ambivalence for me in the presentation of the subject matter. And by that I mean, I don't know if the film is on the side of any one person or if it's only on the side of its own sense of very monstrous, murderous coolness.
Yeah, that was part of my whole thing. It's like, well, what exactly is this movie trying to say about what it's saying and showing?
It is so immersed in the unreality / reality of its narrative that I think that the film wants a pass from having to have any sort of fixed grasp on whatever moral questions it decides to just splatter against the wall.
Yeah, a point of view.
Is it daring or is it just a plain old bad idea when you ground a film so much in one specific decade, the 1960s, that it takes on that decade's regressive attitudes towards the relationships between women and men, mental health, sex work? Or because all of the things that this film, if this film were a straightforward reality, you know, based film, if this were about a woman today,
yes,
and it is, but if it were about a woman today who was still always in the present day,
right,
and the film gave me the kind of attitudes about the subjects that it covers, the way that it does here,
yeah,
I'd say to myself, I'm sorry, what the hell is going on?
Yeah.
This is, in fact, 2021, and we don't think these things about these things anymore.
Well, it seems to drag all of that into 2021, which is my problem.
Yeah. Now, on the flip side of this, do we give horror films, and particularly psychological horror films like this the way that we did in the 60s and 70s? Do we give them the freedom to be as wrong as they are when they are trying to dig into a different sort of wrong? Like, what is the film getting at? And do we expect it to get at anything if it is taking place 60 years ago?
I think that we do not give white, straight, cis guys the license to make movies now that we might have in the 1960s.
All right.
And that if a woman wanted to tell this story now and examine the differences between attitudes and what those, how those might manifest in a modern context, that to me would seem like more of a, this is a commentary, this is a, you know, point of view. I feel like when Edgar Wright is doing it, it's just an exercise in style, and then it winds up throwing out whatever other ideas or points of view that this movie might have had going with it.
I know we're talking around some stuff right now, yes, because we don't want to give away
we're not trying to
stuff
to spoil. Yeah.
But it seems to me that the only people in the present day in this film who are, you know, carrying over those very regressive attitudes are the older characters. Does that mean that the film is doing it? See, this is the thing. It's fiction. These are fictional people.
Yeah.
But is the film on their side? And that is the part where I'm sort of stuck. And I just finished watching this movie like an hour ago.
Right.
So I need more time to sift through it in my head. But
this might be one of those
left
ones we have
with,
to,
yeah,
we might have to come back later and do the spoiler episode, because things I need to talk about here are very much couched in stuff I do not want to talk about yet.
Yeah. So if it were a film that were not so planted in that earlier decade,
yeah,
I would immediately say, wrong.
Oh no.
but the fact that these characters are living and breathing in that space,
yeah,
and everything they think is wrong, and they're allowed to think those things,
right? But I think there's a difference between, like, here's what the characters think and how they behave, and the movie saying, here's what the movie thinks about that and who the
right
movie is,
yeah,
championing or demonizing.
I'm a little stuck in what I think about that.
Yeah. Well,
having said this, the performances are fine.
The wigs are amazing.
I think the performances are often secondary to the overall sort of nightmarish mystery quality of the film. It is definitely, from a visual perspective, from a directorial perspective, certainly cinematography and art direction, it is an extravagant swirl of stuff.
Yes.
And boy, it's got those Argento colors on top of more colors on top of more colors.
And it's his first horror movie, unless you count the trailer for Don't.
Right. So I guess my overall question is, in horror, and that is what I'm going to call this, we are rooting simultaneously for chaos and order. But whose order are we rooting for here?
Well, but I
think, whose order is the film rooting for?
I think
here?
That horror, oftentimes at its best, when it, you know, is manifesting something that is terrible, as it's making a statement on that being terrible, basically,
yeah,
I guess, to put it clumsily. And I think that this movie kind of blurs that line to a way that it seems like either he didn't think it all the way through, or it didn't occur to him that the most obvious reading is something that maybe he didn't see coming.
I mean, I'll be very blunt. I want a film that deals with, you know, mental health to, you know, give me something other than that as
horror in itself.
I don't want it to just be background noise. I want you to talk to me about what this person is doing with their life, and to work to destigmatize rather than make it more exotic and frightening.
Yes.
And that is where I get stuck. That's primarily it. The other thing is with the angle of the narrative of sex work that takes place in the film. I want to know
more.
Whose side are we on?
Yeah.
Yeah. I know whose side I'm on in House of Gucci. Segue. But first.
Say, speaking of designers.
We have something to tell you. Do you need a furniture? I think you do.
Do you want the best furniture?
Do you want really good furniture? The kind that you know, like we did, save up your nice money for. Mm-hmm. And then one day go, hey, look, we have enough money for some nice, things.
Furniture.
Let's get a furniture. And
it will last us.
Yeah. And so you would go to rogerandchris.com if you wanted to do that. They have more designs, styles, colors, fabrics, legs, bolts.
You name it.
Sutures that you can shake a stick at. You go on the website. You design your own thing, honestly. You pick from their choices.
Yeah.
And if you need help, they help you. And then you put it through. They build it here in the United States in their factories. And then they ship it to you. And then you're happy.
Yes.
It's very sturdy. It's very beautiful.
You have a furniture.
RogerandChris.com. This is the penultimate ad that we're doing for them. Only okay. One more left.
All right.
I think that means I need to finish my jingle.
Get on that.
I mean, you know, David and Joanna, they made a good little mini jingle, but,
yeah.
You know, I need my rhymes to live immortally. Who else is going to tell you that you want to kiss?
Can you write something as brilliant as Liberty, Liberty, Liberty?
Liberty. I don't know if I can, because we all know the tune and the words to that.
Yes. RogerandChris.com. Thank you for your sponsorship.
House of Gucci.
Yep.
From Ridley Scott.
Uh-huh.
Here's what happened. So Maurizio Gucci, who's the son, or rather the grandson of the founder of Gucci, Guccio Gucci was his actual name.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's brand commitment.
Yeah. He married a woman named Patrizia in the early 1980s.
Actually, in the early 70s in real life.
Okay, well, I'm going with what the movie tells me.
Yes.
Because I don't know anything about this family until I'm sitting down to watch this movie.
Neither did I. I Googled it later.
So they marry each other. Maurizio is played by Adam Driver. Patrizia is played by Lady Gaga. And they get married, but not before they meet in my favorite meet-cute way that I've seen in a very long time. She thinks he's the bartender at a party. He is not. He's just behind the bar getting himself a free drink. She says, hello, I'm Patrizia. He says, hello, I'm Maurizio. She says, Maurizio what? He says, Maurizio Gucci. And Gaga's eyes flash.
That they don't put a star effect over it is like the one.
You don't need it.
Moment of subtlety.
You don't need
this movie
extra lighting. You do not need extra lighting for the way she reacts, because it is the kind of reaction that the audience can see if they're paying attention, and maybe a tipsy man would not.
Yes.
But her eyes flash.
She takes Avery's him.
At the name Gucci. She doesn't overreact. She just does that.
Really?
Oh, really? Well,
we're
going to get to know each other.
Yeah.
She is a woman with a plan. And that plan involves marrying him.
Yes.
And running Gucci, the company, which over the course of several years, she does until she doesn't.
Right.
This is the story, a big, big, long story, over 2.5 hour long story of the way that the Gucci family did everything possible, but, including that. They do everything possible to destroy each other.
Yes.
Because they are so venomous and greedy and terrible.
And lose the company entirely.
Yeah. Until the 90s, Tom Ford comes along and fixes everything, but by then, none of the Guccis are in charge of anything.
Yeah, their lawyer has pretty much booted them all.
Yeah. This is the most ridiculous film that I have seen in, well, not forever, but weeks at least, and I had a really wonderful time watching the extravagant silliness.
I thought it was hilarious, except when it was boring. And I found,
I was never bored.
I was bored a lot. And if I had not been bored so much, then I would be unequivocally recommending this as like a camp nonsense extravaganza. But as it is moments of camp nonsense buffered by a lot of people in meeting rooms talking in ridiculous accents.
Here's my question about the accents.
Yes.
What are we, the English-speaking audience, because this film is primarily in English.
Yes, almost entirely.
There are occasional moments when people do slip into Italian with subtitles, but they are few and far between. Correct. And so they are Italians speaking English for our benefit, and everyone in the film is not Italian.
No.
But they're all doing... All right. I need to explain something about our life. There's an inside joke among our group of friends.
Oh my God.
There's an inside joke in our group of friends. And it involves the recurring presence of a 19th century child ghost dressed as a clown.
You had to be there.
That child ghost's name is Baba Pino. and in our friend group, the voice of Baba Pino in regular routine, absurdly, what are those animated?
It's the app that you use to make your pictures of your dog look like they're talking.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Makes the mouth move.
So the voice of that person, the voice of Baba Pino is our friend and neighbor, Gary Cotti.
Yes.
Who is Italian.
Yes, and let's be very clear about that.
So he actually came up with this with our friend Aaron Aldericio, another Italian.
Yes.
And they think it's hilarious, and now we in turn think it's hilarious. But when Gary does the Baba Pino voice, I laugh until I cry because it is every ridiculous, that's a spicy meatball.
It's a me, Mario. Yeah.
And Jared Leto is doing the Baba Pino voice.
He's gone beyond Baba Pino because he's doing this absurd accent and then throwing in a falsetto for good measure.
And it's more than the accent with Jared Leto. He has beamed in from outer space to be in this movie. I don't know if his character really spoke like this, behaved like this, said routine, outrageous things, but every line of dialogue out of Jared Leto's mouth is offensively stupid and weird. And you begin to hope that he says more of them over time. Like, if any human being would say these things to you in real life, you'd be like, get out of my house. But the more you watch him do this, you just think, this scene could use some Jared Leto.
I think I said in my review, it's either the best or the worst performance he's ever given. Maybe both. But you'll never forget it.
Jeremy Irons is a lovely elderly Dracula in this film. Al Pacino is a wonderfully elderly shouting person. Adam Driver is boring. If there's a boring person at the center of this film, it is Adam Driver. And it is because his character is meant to be
the boring.
Someone who is disinterested in the running of the business.
Right.
But he is sort of like a void in the mix.
But here's the thing. Is Adam Driver giving a boring performance? Or does it just look like he's not doing anything because he's constantly surrounded by this funky bunch?
This carnival of...
Lady Gaga, apparently...
I was fixing to get to her.
...spent months getting the accent right and, like, spoke with it even when the cameras weren't rolling.
Yep.
But the actual language accent consultant for the film was like, I think she sounds Russian. And she kind of... There's a moose and squirrel thing happening with her, which is at least part of the accent, but part of just the whole crazy Alexis Carrington energy that she's bringing to this thing.
I need to put a cap on the accent thing. My question originally was, what are we meant to understand about the accents? That they are really speaking Italian to each other and that we are hearing it in English?
Well, yes. Or,
okay, because... It all just sounds wacky, particularly since all of the accents are kind of different from person to person.
There are five different accents, five different movies, really, because all the performances are pitched at very different levels.
But let's talk about Gaga.
Okay.
She takes command of this film. She's the main character.
Yes.
And good, because if she weren't the main character, she would have just been stealing scenes left and right from everybody. She wears outfits in this movie, and I mean a lot of them. So many outfits. She wears jewelry and wigs and shoes, and she...
Everything is too much.
And she's perfect as that too much.
Right. Like, it's intentionally too
creature.
Much. Because like the Guccis always like to talk about how, oh, their grandfather was a shepherd or whatever. And like, they're not old money, but they all have that camel hair. We know how to dress the part here. Yeah. Even Jared Leto, who verges on the clownish, reins it in to some extent.
I wholeheartedly disagree with you. His outfits are crazy.
Okay, you're
from
right.
start to finish.
His are also nuts. But hers are, I think, very designed to be like, she almost is fancy lady, but instead she's like, you know, it's too tight. There's too many polka dots.
Right.
She's wearing red and everybody else is wearing white. Like, there's always something that's just a little extra going on.
Gaga takes this movie, picks it up, attaches it like a giant bow to her wig and carries it around.
She carries it around like a designer knockoff handbag that she proudly flashes to the world.
And I am into it. This is a bad movie. It is hilarious. She's amazing. And it's 3 hours of nonsense.
Yeah, it's a bad movie that I wish were worse, because I think it would be more fun if it were just nonstop lunacy.
Had just the right amount of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wish I wanted to have that experience. I was too often bored and occasionally like, what?
There's plenty to love hate here.
Oh, no question.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is for sure.
And you know, Ridley Scott is no amateurs. This thing looks beautiful and it just glides all the way. I like this bad movie.
Okay. I did not care for it.
Okay.
I did care for Licorice Pizza, and you can go read my review of that at The Wrap, and we're going to talk about it when Dave sees it. Which
are they going to send us a screener? I'm mad about that.
They had a bunch of press screenings. I think they really want people to see it in 70mm.
Of course.
Look, you and I are going to go on like a weekday at noon when it's not crowded.
Well,
and
it's probably going to be after Christmas because that's when it opens nationwide.
Oh.
And
I thought we were going to try and go. See, I think if we went to the Westwood Village on like a Tuesday, it would not be that bad.
Well, I don't know about that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
We'll figure it out.
Okay. We got some letters.
We do.
Let's pick up the ones that we skipped last week.
Okay.
Uh, Shoddy sent us two of them, and I've combined.
Mm.
She says, "Dear Dave and Alonzo, King Richard is fanatical, covertly religious, and therefore very, very dangerous, as the obstacles in this movie are staged as biblical tests of faith."
Mm.
For the record, Richard Williams was a psychopath. Who had, what was? He's still alive. We're calling him a psychopath. Richard Williams, if you're here listening, I am not calling you a psychopath. Shoddy is calling you a psychopath. This is all on Shoddy.
Yes.
He had 10 kids, and he hid his second wife's birth control because he specifically wanted to create two tennis stars. This is the behavior of an insane person. I'm wondering what Dave, as a person who grew up in an environment that required blind dedication, thinks of this movie. Well, you know, I can only go with what the movie gave me. This is what we said last week.
Right.
And my questions are along the lines of what you've written here. Like, who is this guy? And what drives him? You know, the film tells you that his experience with, you know, institutional racism in the United States is what drives him. And that's, you know, I'm sure that was part of it. But is there something else?
Right.
Is there something in addition to that that drives him? And the movie is very soft about
exploring
those things. And so the fact that Venus and Serena Williams, you know, produced this movie makes me wonder, like, what they think about all of this. What I think they think is that everything turned out fine. Mm. So I don't quite know where to land still on this film.
Yeah.
All I know is that, you know, I would like to see a narrative biopic about Venus and Serena. There's a documentary, but, you know. Anyway, Shoddy continues. Every parent should nourish their children's natural interests and talents, but requiring your kids to be rich and famous is absolutely egomaniacal, which is what this movie ultimately endorses. You can also be sure of the fact that King Richard will give a lot of unbalanced parents the permission to treat their children with this type of abandon, this reckless abandon, especially the religious ones. And let's not forget, Will Smith once made a movie about a man who forced his child to spend the night in a subway station bathroom because he dreamed of becoming a stockbroker. Stockbroker is in all caps here, and for emphasis, and I think...
That is absolutely true.
That is absolutely...
He did make that movie.
True. Just like you, I wanted to see a Venus and Serena movie where they wore funky spandex and screamed at racist referees for 2 hours. Instead, I got another Scientology mind-hacking video with Will Smith doing SNL acting. On a lighter note, I hope Lady Gaga and Jeremy Irons each win an Oscar for House of Gucci, and I hope Jared Leto wins all 4 male acting awards at the Golden Globes.
Drama, comedy, and musical.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for your letters, Shoddy.
Thank you, Shoddy.
Jesse says, "Dear Dave and Alonzo, particularly Dave, this stands as a record that for the last few weeks, Dave, you have, in lovingly and supportively promoting Alonzo's book release, super-duper bagged on your own book. As a dedicated listener for over a decade, as well as someone who followed you from your days at iFilm, Dave, I do not appreciate you talking about a book that I have pointedly kept and moved over 5 times. Moving books is a pain, Dave. I've donated a lot of books, especially ahead of my most recent interstate move. Are you suggesting that I do not have good taste? I'll have you know, sir, that I have a bachelor's degree in comprehensive literature from a state university. Albeit the state of Wisconsin, which you seem determined not to be able to identify on a map."
Coastal elites.
I've written papers on novels by Toni Morrison, Edith Wharton, Joseph Conrad. I find it hurtful that you undermine my credentials thusly. In all seriousness, I know Dave does not like to read praise about himself. It gives him, and I believe this is the professional term, the squirmies. But for real, Dave, stop dunking on yourself and that book. It was a good and entertaining book about a good and entertaining person. in the words of your namesake and fellow modern poet, Dave Coulier, in his generation-defining turn as Uncle Joey, cut it out. In order to show that I too can be vulnerable, I will do what I've heretofore not done in my decade plus of listening to y'all, because I'm consumed with worry that my sometimes pedestrian tastes and boring white ladyism will open me up to judgment and derision. Below is a top 10 list of movies and films that I find comforting.
Okay.
Knife away. Like Dave, I get the squirmies ranking or listing things as I'm in the wind, baby. Oh, as I'm the wind, baby, and my favorites and obsessions frequently change. Before you read this, I just want to defensively state that I went to that Portuguese film about a queer ornithologist that Dave recommended a few years ago, so it's not like I don't challenge myself, okay? y'all, two things before I read the list. I'm sorry for insulting my own book. I have legitimate, I believe, problems with elements of the book as they stand now. From a writing standpoint, and from a, you know, a perspective standpoint. I think of myself as a writer who has grown, and when I look back on my work from 2005, and in reality from 1999, when it all started, I look at it and I go, I don't know anymore. You know what I mean? Yeah. So like, that's where that's all coming from. But I'll stop.
You were Eve Plum, and that book is the period where you played Jan Brady.
I will cut it out. In the meantime, do please go find the film The Ornithologist. It is an incredible Portuguese film that you won't forget. It's pretty wild, and I love it. Here's the list. Number 10, You've Got Mail. She says, let's just get it out of the way, okay? I've loved Tom Hanks since Splash, can't help it. Yeah, who doesn't love Tom Hanks?
Sure.
Who doesn't love Meg Ryan? That movie's cozy.
I guess.
I saw that movie twice for Parker Posey. Speaking of cozy, Parker Posey's my cozy.
All I can think of while I'm watching that movie is why I could be watching Shop Around the Corner right now.
I know. Number 9, Hot Fuzz. Really, the entire Cornetto trilogy. We agree with you.
Absolutely.
Number 8, It's a Wonderful Life. That's an important film of the past century.
Yeah.
It's one of the most important films of the past century in America, American filmmaking. It is not the film that people think it is.
No.
If they've never seen it, or if they've only seen it casually a couple times on TV or whatever. Yeah. It's a noir.
Yeah.
Clueless. We love it. The Fugitive. And she adds, I'm sorry that Tommy Lee Jones is a garbage pile, Alonso.
Oh, we're all sorry, but yes, he's good in that.
We have a love-hate with Tommy Lee Jones.
I know. Love the work.
We love him as an actor. Every time I see him in a movie, I go, ah, Tommy Lee Jones, you're so good. You were so mean to my husband that one time. Don't like you.
Believe me. I feel very conflicted. Every time I see him and he's great in something, I'm like, oh, Tommy Lee Jones.
So great. He was so mean to you.
Yes.
All right. The Muppet Movie.
Oh, well.
Unassailable.
Yeah. It's as cozy as it gets.
Spy. Hilarious.
Yeah.
And good. Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
Hot Rod. Hot Rod's great.
Hot Rod's hilarious.
Number 1, Sense and Sensibility.
The Colin Firth version, right?
I don't know which one.
Oh, okay.
She didn't say which one.
I thought she said it was the BBC one, and it's not a movie technically, but what the heck.
Oh, she wants to list the BBC Pride and Prejudice from 95.
Right. Yeah. That's the Colin Firth one, right?
I guess.
Yeah.
All right, sure. She says, yours in You've Got Mail. Jesse. Jesse, we're going to give you a 95% knife on that list because we only kind of half hate You've Got Mail. We get the appeal.
Yes, certainly. It's very Nora Ephron.
It's not good, but it's also not bad.
Yeah.
I mean, it's bad.
It's
bad, but you just sit and watch it.
Yeah.
Plus, it's got the all-time great typing performance from Meg Ryan.
Oh, that's true. Move over, Jerry Lewis.
Yeah. All right. Here's from Andrew. Mm-hmm. Andrew is in Australia, just yes. FYI.
Yes.
And he begins his letter with, G'day.
Oh, bless.
Late sending this through, but Alonso, what don't you like about Joel Edgerton? He has a nice handshake and is very good in Animal Kingdom.
He is good in Animal Kingdom.
He was also perfectly fine, high praise in Sample People, a rare entry in Kylie Minogue's late 90s acting career alongside the film Cut.
Have you seen Sample People?
I have never seen Sample People.
Has Matt Severson seen Sample
People? Probably.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. I hear he's widely disliked by a fair chunk of non-Aussies in the world and have never been able to see what there isn't to like about him. I often wonder if actors like Joel Edgerton and, to a lesser extent, Sam Worthington, who was excellent in Kate Shortland's Somersault and Rob Connolly's Paper Planes, and Jai Courtney, great in the movie Felony alongside Joel Edgerton, they get disliked because of being heavily miscast in American productions when they were so great in their homeland films and shows. I'm tempting fate in case your response suddenly turns me off of Joel Edgerton, but I must know. Thank you from the defensive Aussie, Andrew.
Thanks for writing, Andrew. No, I don't. Dislike is even maybe putting too fine a point on it. He's just one of those movies, one of those people I see him in a movie and I'm like, okay. Like, he rarely thrills me. So when he does thrill me, it's noteworthy, like in Animal Kingdom, like in The Green Knight. I did not care for Boy Erased, which he directed. But yeah, he's just one of those actors where I'm sort of like, you know, every so often they'll do something that I think is really interesting and I'll be into it. But other times they just sort of seem to be occupying space. There's another Australian guy who falls in this category and I can never remember his name. He played the lead in that Nicole Holofcener movie for Netflix, The Land of Something Decisions. You remember what I'm talking about?
Why you put me on the spot?
I got to pause. Right. He's that's how forgettable he is. I can never remember his name. Hang on. Ben Mendelsohn.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The Land of Steady Habits is the Nicole Holofcener movie. Yeah. Ben Mendelsohn is one of those guys who's either going to be like interesting and is going to pop for me, or he's going to be wallpaper.
Okay.
And that's kind of how I feel about Joel Edgerton.
All right.
So it's not like an active dislike. I don't turn off a movie that they're in it, but I just think, all right, is it pop or wallpaper? What do we got?
I do not share your disinterest with Joel Edgerton.
Okay.
Because let's leave Boy Erased out of it because I'm under-distanced from that film and I don't know if it's good or bad.
Sure.
All I know is that it affected me.
Yes.
Warrior is an all-timer. I will take that film to my bosom for my life till I'm dead. Warrior is that good. It is absolutely moving and just such an emotionally, you know, resonant film.
People, straight guys love Warrior.
Well, I'm not straight. I love Warrior.
You straight guys and Dave White love Warrior. But it's like, you know, when everybody was having... just was losing their minds this morning on Twitter over the announcement.
Jen Yamato agrees with me about Warrior.
Good for her.
Yeah. She's not a straight guy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Straight guys and Dave White and Jen Yamato.
Yeah, what else?
Anyway, it's like everybody losing their minds this morning over the announcement that they're doing a third Magic Mike movie.
Okay.
I don't get what the excitement's about. I've never been into those films, but you know, some people love them.
All right.
I'm trying to say I'm right about everything.
Sam Worthington has not been served well by the United States film industry.
As someone who had to sit through The Ledge.
He's very good looking, but we don't know what kind of an actor he is based on the films that he has made in the United States.
Is he in the Avatar sequels? Do we know?
Who knows? Maybe. Jai Courtney, you can tell he's got something going on, but again, so often the films he's in over here are just sort of like not great.
Yeah. I think Jai Courtney, I want to see play more villains because he's so good at that. He's so good in Jack Reacher. He's so good in...
And he's even better looking than Sam Worthington, so...
Yeah. he was in one of...
We're ranking male beauty here.
Whatever one of the dumb Liam Neeson movies I had to review last year, there were like 18 of them. He was a bad guy in that, and he was like, he steals the movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well... All of that to say this, Alonzo's wrong about Joel Edgerton. Andrew, you've always got a friend in me.
I can only,
if not Alonzo.
I can only go with my gut here.
Your gut's wrong. Okay, we're done here. I got to make dinner.
Fine. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Please check out our friends on the internet. Why don't you, check out the other podcasts that I co-host. Maximum Film on the Maximum Fun Network. Breakfast All Day with the folks you love from What the Flick, which no longer exists, but now Breakfast All Day does. And weekly, I pop up on Deck the Hallmark to talk about Netflix movies.
I popped up on this week.
Yes. Everybody go listen to their Nine Kittens of Christmas episode.
We talked about the Nine Kittens of Christmas.
With Dave White
making
the scene, making his Deck the Hallmark debut and blowing everybody out of the water.
Yep.
Speaking of Deck the Hallmark, those guys and I wrote a book. It's called that's my old one. It's called I'll Be Home for Christmas.
What's the name of the books? What are the names of the books you've written?
The Deck the Hallmark guys and I wrote I'll Be Home for Christmas movies.
Right.
It's brand new. It's available wherever you buy books. And it makes a great gift this holiday season. Tomorrow is December. Yee. Where did this year go? I mean, this year was a nightmare, but still, I can't believe it's December. Anyway. Pick that book up. And you can also pick up my previous book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. Why not?
You can bundle them.
You can. It's true. Amazon and other websites would be happy to do that for you.
Yeah.
You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review. We will read it on the air. Like this one by Abe Jackson, who says, listener for years. Loved listening to you guys for years. Thanks for keeping me entertained / company for countless lunches, work shifts, and walks. Heart emoji. Well, heart emoji back to you, Abe. Thank you for listening. We appreciate
it. Thank you, Abe.
You can also leave positive feedback in the many places where we stream, like Spotify, Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Apple Music, Google Play, CastBox, Podbean. You can follow us on social media at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with thoughts, questions, top 10 lists, whatever you like. We are coming into a busy time of year, a lot of new movies opening. We're getting access to movies that we did not see over the fall when we weren't going out to theaters. So lots more to come. Probably even be still catching up probably in early January.
I imagine. For sure. Because we're our last episode of this month is going to be the one right before Christmas, and then we're taking like 10 days off.
Yeah. So we'll do what we can in the time that we have, as do we all. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week, and we'll be back next time with more. Until then,
goodbye.